does God exist? What is the sun? What is the purpose of existence? What is everything made of? How big is the world? How does one live a good moral life? These are fundamental human questions that have probably been asked from the very dawn of human consciousness. But between the years 700 and 500 BC, all around the world, people simultaneously began to pose these questions and to formulate a number of creative new answers to them. This process often involved challenging traditional beliefs and ways of doing things. This era was the time of great and original thinkers, such as Buddha in India, Confucius in China, Zoroaster in Persia, and a group of innovative philosophers in Greece. Over the course of this lecture and the next, we will examine each of these figures, as well as a number of others, all of whom dared to ask those big questions of life. And we'll survey the many influential and long-lasting religions and philosophies that emerged from this amazing historical moment. One possible distinction that we can make among all of these various thinkers, philosophers, and mystics is between those whose main focus was on this life and those whose attention was centered on some sort of existence beyond just the physical one. In the first category, we can place those whose main interest was in investigating and explaining the natural world, as well as those who sought to find a better way to organize society and to regulate human behavior. The second group was more concerned with God or the gods. They were concerned with the afterlife and exploring spiritual and mystical aspects of human nature and really consciousness itself. In reality, most of the belief systems that we're going to look at incorporate some elements of both approaches. But I think this division will offer a nice structural organization for analysis. So, this lecture will look at some of the thinkers whose main focus was on this world and on pragmatic issues concerning the nature of the world and how to set up society. And in the next lecture, we'll look at their more spiritually inclined counterparts. So, let's begin in China around 500 BC. And this was the time of great political turmoil of the Warring States period. But it's also the time of the intellectual blossoming of the era of 100 schools of thought. And in China around then, there lived a man named Kung, who would eventually become known as Master Kung, or in Chinese, Kung Fu Zi, which, of course, was later Latinized by Jesuit missionaries into the name by which he's popularly known in the Western world today, Confucius. Confucius was born into a fairly low-level aristocratic family that had fallen on hard times. His father had been in the military, but Confucius decided that he would pursue a career as a sort of political advisor. And so he spent most of his adult life traveling around from court to court, basically seeking a job and trying to find a sympathetic ruler who would put into practice some of the ideas that he was coming up with. Now, in that career, he was a failure. He never gained the sort of position he sought, but he did write down his thoughts in a book called The Analects. And after his death, his teachings and that book would become hugely influential. Confucius's personal disappointments seem to have been paralleled by a dissatisfaction with the entire time in which he lived. As he wandered around from kingdom to kingdom in search of a job, he witnessed firsthand all sorts of inhuman behavior that clearly very much distressed him. But it also seems to have inspired him to encourage other people to become more moral and to at least try to do good. At this time, the once powerful Zhou dynasty had fallen into clear decline, and China had lapsed into the confusion of the Warring States period. But Confucius chose instead to look back to the early period of Zhou rule, and he viewed that as a kind of golden age, or at least it offered a template for behavior and how to structure society. So to Confucius, living in a time of near anarchy, that earlier Zhou period represented an era of order, of stability, and of justice. For Confucius, even though the political structure of his time had disintegrated and fallen apart, he still saw order in the everyday rituals of domestic life. And so he very much fastened onto these as a cornerstone upon which to build his ideal society. A strongly hierarchical family structure had always been a central part of the Chinese ethos. And one was always expected to honor your parents and really to observe almost absolute obedience to them. Part of this also was ancestor worship. And this took the form of rituals, which had to be strictly followed. And you would perform sacrifices, which in a sense extended that respect even after death. Confucius looked at these traditions of filial piety and ritual as being crucial to holding society together. He also thought that social harmony could be cultivated and maintained if those who were in positions of authority and power lived their lives so as to set good moral examples for others to follow. So Confucius has really fundamentally a basically positive concept of human nature, in which he thinks individuals are inclined to be good, but for a just society, they just need that little bit of sort of push and inspiration of humane behavior being modeled by their social betters. Confucius sees society as resting or even being composed of a series of relationships that themselves are fundamentally hierarchical. So the ruler is obviously above the subject. The husband is above the wife, the father above the son, and so on. And as long as the superior in each of those relationships acts with sincerity, benevolence, and justice, then the subordinate will respond with the appropriate deference, obedience, and respect, and all would be well. A key concept to Confucius was Ren, which is often translated as civility, goodness, or humaneness. And the idea is that if only everyone cultivated this Ren, the result would be a tranquil, orderly, and happy society. In the Analects, for example, he says, "One who can bring about the practice of five things everywhere has achieved Ren: courtesy, tolerance, good faith, diligence, and kindness." Confucius urged that people should always maintain an attitude of modesty, loyalty, respect, and really keeping a firm hold on your emotions, keeping them under control. Several times in the course of the Analects, Confucius advocates what amount to versions of the Golden Rule as being a useful guide to proper behavior. For example, in a passage, he writes, "Shi Gong asked of Confucius, 'Is there a single word such that one could practice it throughout one's life?' The master said, 'Reciprocity. Do not inflict on others what you yourself would not wish done to you.'" Confucius thought that setting a good moral example would be really more effective in creating an ideal society than trying to coerce people through laws or punishments. And this belief also shows up explicitly right at the beginning of the Analects. There, he writes, "If you lead them by government and keep order among them by means of punishments, the people are without conscience in evading them. If you lead them by means of virtue and keep order among them by means of ritual, they have a conscience and moreover will submit." Although Confucius did not deny the existence of gods or spirits, and in general he endorsed religious rituals as being useful ones, clearly the focus of his philosophy is much more on this world and on pragmatic issues of how society should be ordered and set up rather than on more abstract spiritual concerns. When once asked directly about the existence of an afterlife, Confucius declined to give any concrete answer, and he simply stated that it's impossible to know what truly happens after death. Although Confucianism today is often considered a religion, and certainly it's deeply concerned with ethics, morals, and behavior, initially it was more of a philosophical system. But later, in reaction to Buddhism, it starts to pick up some more overtly religious elements, such as priests, temples, and monasteries. But Confucianism did not at first have those sort of cultic overtones. An alternative philosophy aimed at organizing and running the state that also developed during the Warring States period was legalism. Whereas Confucianism flowed from the belief that human beings were basically good and moral in nature, even if needing a little bit of guidance by way of example to behave that way, legalism had a much more pessimistic view. The legalists said that, or believed, humans were fundamentally selfish, and that the only way that they could be made to act well was through strict laws and coercion. So, legalistic scholars endorsed a powerful, centralized state, and they emphasized things like order and discipline, at the expense, I should say, of individual liberty or individual rights. As you might imagine, legalism is very appealing to kings or rulers or regimes that tend to emphasize authoritarianism and militarism as well. In a simplistic sense, Confucianism and legalism can both, I suppose, be seen as emphasizing order. But Confucianism teaches that this could be achieved through positive examples, whereas legalism advocates the use of force and threats. In a way, these two philosophies pose that classic question, what's more effective as motivation, the carrot or the stick? And in reality, over time, Chinese officials often ended up practicing kind of a combination or a mixture of these two approaches. In Greece, at this very same time, emerged a group of philosophers who also took a very practical approach in trying to answer some of those big fundamental questions about human existence. But a difference is that rather than being concerned with how to organize society or to run it, the initial group of these Greek philosophers instead focused their attention on simply trying to explain the natural world that they found all around them. This first wave of Greek philosophers is called the Ionian rationalists, and they get started around 600 BC. Sometimes more commonly in books and things, you'll see them referred to as the pre-Socratic philosophers, meaning literally the Greek philosophers that came before Socrates. But I like the slightly more obscure term Ionian rationalists, because I think it's a more descriptive label, and it's one that tells us some important things about who they were. Let me break down that name a little bit, and begin with the second word, rationalist. And think about, what does this mean in terms of what it tells us about these men? Well, they were the first to look at the world around them and to try to come up with logical explanations for why stuff happens. So, rather than simply accepting a mythological explanation, as had been done in the past, for things like rain, wind, the seasons, instead, they tried to interpret these phenomena not as acts of the gods, but in a way that today we would call scientific. This was a truly radical way of thinking about the natural world. I mean, it may seem natural to us today, but for them, this was a totally different way to look at nature. And to those people who strictly followed the religious beliefs of the time, they would have seen this sort of questioning as sacrilegious. The inquiries of these men led them to explore a number of different intellectual directions. So some of the Ionian rationalists very much concentrated on explaining the natural world, and they focused on issues such as measurement, standards, mathematics, and geometry. Since, after all, the very first step towards understanding the world is you have to be able to accurately and precisely describe it. Others among them, who had a little bit more abstract focus, began to speculate about the fundamental nature or organization of the universe itself. And they tended to forward or develop disciplines such as logic and reason and what today, again, we would call critical thinking. Skepticism, meaning that you don't accept what you're told without some sort of proof or evidence, was a major part of all the rationalist approach. And this led them to have an emphasis on personal observation as a way of verifying information. And a logical next step from this was to begin to conduct experiments. So you would come up with a hypothesis, and you would try to test it out. And many Ionian rationalists actually carried out such experiments in a variety of fields. And all of these are absolutely revolutionary ideas. Up to this point, most people had simply accepted what they had been told. And they had been trained to see the world as a place that was just mysterious, that was ruled by inexplicable forces that humans couldn't be expected to understand. But the Greek rationalists challenged, and really for all time, changed that idea. The first word in that phrase, Ionian rationalist, Ionian, is also an important one. The movement, if we can call it that, which embodies these characteristics, began and thrived in a region called Ionia. Now, Ionia was an area on the coast of Asia Minor. Today, that coastline and also the islands just offshore are mostly owned by Turkey. But in antiquity, these are firmly part of the Greek cultural world. Now, Ionia was located in a very interesting place, geographically speaking, because it's right on the border between the Greek world on the one side and the older inland civilizations of the Near East and Mesopotamia on the other. So Ionia, in a way, is at the crossroads of all the major trade routes that link together east and west. It's a border zone. And in places like that, you always tend to get mixing together of different philosophies, religions, cultures, economies. It's the kind of place where walking down the streets of an Ionian city, you might run into Egyptians, Persians, Jews, Phoenicians, and Greeks, all intermingling together. Not only was Ionia a place characterized by a volatile intellectual climate, but its political life was also unsettled. Ionia, again, is typical of border regions, was contested territory, and it was claimed by both the Greeks and the Persians. In addition to that threat of external invasion, Ionia was internally troubled. There were all sorts of factions fighting one another. There were frequent civil wars. There was class strife. And so Ionian rationalism comes out of the same kind of chaotic political and social context as Confucianism and legalism. The first of the Ionian rationalists is usually considered to be a guy named Thales of Miletus. He started out life as a merchant who, in the course of pursuing his business, had traveled to Egypt. And so it seems like there he would have been exposed to older Egyptian, maybe even Chaldean ideas and knowledge about things like mathematics and astronomy. One of his most famous achievements was he used his understanding of mathematics and astronomy to predict a total eclipse of the sun that took place in 585 BC. His greatest contribution, though, was simply to begin to question and challenge the traditional explanations of the natural world. And it's Thales who came up with two questions, which would really kind of obsess all subsequent Ionian rationalists. The first is, what is the world made of? And what is the basic unit which composes all other things? Now, today, using modern terminology, we might identify that as the atom, which, by the way, is a term made up by another Greek rationalist. But Thales called it the antecedent of all things, or a little more colloquially, the first element. And he reasoned that since everything that he observed with personal observation seemed to be nourished by water, everything seems to need water to survive and grow, then he hypothesized that water must be the first element. He also speculated about the nature of the universe. He theorized that the Earth was a sort of a flat body that floated on top of water like a raft. And, I mean, here you can clearly see him moving away from all those traditional concepts of the gods that we saw in Homer with Zeus and Athena and figures like that. Thales seemed to have believed that the gods, or even just the abstract divine, was infused in everything, that people possessed souls that were linked to all other souls, and so everything was related to one another. One of his key characteristics that he ascribed to the soul, and I guess by extension to all living creatures, is that they're capable of movement. And this logic led him to some interesting conclusions. For example, he observed that magnets could move. If you put two magnets near one another, they'll be drawn to one another. And so he speculated, maybe playfully, maybe not, that they too must have souls. Even after he becomes a philosopher, he didn't lose his basic instincts as a merchant. And according to one legend, he used his newfound knowledge of astronomy to predict when the olive crop would ripen. And this then enabled him to invest and sort of corner the market and make a financial killing on olives. One of Thales' students was Anaximander. And Anaximander expanded on his teacher's theories. Anaximander is the first person we know of to have tried to make a map of the entire world. And of course, that reveals a fundamental interest in geometry and measurement, those key characteristics of Ionian rationalists. He was also the leader of a colony, and we know that he enjoyed wearing fancy and impressive clothing. His theorizing about the first element led him to believe that it was not water or any other substance, but instead he said it was something which he termed the indefinite. And his particular variation on the structure of the universe was that the Earth was originally covered in water, and then it dried up when exposed to the heat of the sun, and land appeared. And so he speculated, based on this, that mankind must be descended from fish-like creatures. And in a way, this makes him a forerunner, I suppose, to evolutionary theory. Another of the important rationalists was Xenophanes. He started out by profession as a poet. And the main direction of his theorizing was to challenge the conventional ideas about the Greek gods. He openly made fun of the idea that the gods look just like sort of big people. And he said that that concept of the gods was obviously just an egotistical, man-made creation. And to try and illustrate this point, in his writings, he said, well, if cattle or horses had hands so that they could paint and produce works of art as men do, they would paint their gods and give them bodies in form like their own, cattle like cattle and horses like horses. His vision of religion was explicitly monotheistic. So he believed that there was a single divine being who, he says, was not like humans in either body or mind. Instead, he was all sight and all mind and all hearing, and he remains in one place, not moving. I said, it is not seemly that a god or god should be now here and now there. He moves all things without effort by thought alone. Xenophanes thought that the world went through cycles that alternated between earth and sea, or I guess phases when it was dry and covered in water. And he based this on a personal observation. And this was that he could see fossils of fish even high in the mountains. So he correctly deduced that those marks, these fossils, must have been left there at a time when that region was underwater. When it came to the prime element, Xenophanes leaned towards Earth as being most likely. Finally, one of the most colorful and also important figures of the second wave of Ionian rationalists was a man named Pythagoras. He liked to call himself a lover of wisdom, or in Greek, a philosophos. And it's from that that our terms philosopher and philosophy derive. He too seems to have traveled very widely. He supposedly visited Egypt as well as sites in the Near East, where he also may have picked up elements of Eastern thinking. And Pythagoras' ideas can really be broken down into two main categories. And we might call these mathematics on the one hand and mysticism on the other, although he probably didn't see much difference between them. In the realm of mathematics, Pythagoras came up with many of the fundamental cornerstones of geometry, including, of course, the Pythagorean theorem, which is named for him. He thought that the first element was the abstract quality of number. He said that the number one, he called it the monad, and said it was male, and that two was dyad, and was female. And if you think about this, what he's really describing is something very akin to our modern concept of binary number systems. He also made important advances in astronomy, particularly regarding the movements of the planets. And in Pythagoras' view, the whole universe was put together along mathematically precise lines. He also thought that mathematics and music were interrelated disciplines. And so this led to what will become a very famous idea that as the planets move along these sort of perfect mathematically described paths through the heavens, that they create beautiful sounds. And this is most commonly referred to as the music of the spheres. On the other hand, Pythagoras was also what we would today would call very superstitious. He said that you should never poke at a fire with a knife because you might injure it. He said you should always spit on your nail clippings to prevent someone from using them against you by using them in a magical incantation. He believed in transmigration of souls, even into animals, and reincarnation. And he claimed that he himself could remember four previous lives, including one in which he had lived at the time of the Trojan War. One famous story about him is that one day he saw a neighbor beating a dog, and Pythagoras ran up and said, "Stop, stop, I recognize that dog as the reincarnation of an old friend." He also, of course, advocated vegetarianism, so that you would avoid unintentionally eating deceased friends and relatives. Pythagoras really seems to have been a kind of flamboyant figure. There's many descriptions of him dressing in eccentric outfits, such as a big golden hat, long white robes and trousers. I always imagine Pythagoras looks a lot like how we tend to envision our modern cliche of a wizard. Living during similar times of political and social uncertainty, Confucius and the Ionian rationalists both respond by really confronting head-on the uncertainties of this world. And what they do is they offer up new visions of society and the physical world. While Confucius looked backwards and embraced tradition, the rationalists, though, challenge it. Underlying both of them is a basic belief and really confidence in the power of human thought to come up with answers to these questions. Both believe that the human mind has the power to comprehend the world, to make sense of it, and that the solutions to problems can be reached through rational thought and logical analysis. Now, faith and trust in the power of the human mind to solve problems is not the only possible response to these sort of big questions that were being asked. There were many others who believed that real answers could not be reached by cold calculation or observation, but instead they could only be achieved through more mystical and spiritual means, and by focusing on those things which were divine and really beyond the realm of human sensory perception. And those sorts of thinkers will be the topic of the next lecture. Thank you.